3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting the United States is sending envoys to the Russian-sponsored Syria ceasefire talks set to begin Wednesday in the Kazakh capital, Astana. The White House confirmed the move following Tuesday's talks between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. The White House said the two leaders also discussed the development of safe zones to achieve lasting peace for humanitarian and many other reasons. Tuesday's phone call between President Trump and President Putin was their first dialogue since Russia condemned a U.S. military attack against Syria last month in response to a nerve gas attack launched on civilians by Syrian forces. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson described the conversations between the two leaders as constructive.
It was a very constructive call that the two presidents had. Very, very fulsome call, a lot of detailed exchanges. So we'll see where we go from here.
How long did it last?
I'm not sure I even kept track of the time.
The Kremlin released a statement that Putin and Trump agreed to have Tillerson and his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, step up discussions on a ceasefire for the six-year-long, that is, conflict in Syria. The White House said both leaders also agreed during the call that the suffering in Syria has gone on for far too long and that all parties must do all they can to end the violence. President Trump welcomes Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to the White House Wednesday. Trump said last week he sees no reason why there can't be peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Abbas recently said a historic peace deal to end the decades-old conflict is possible under Trump's leadership. For more news, join us at voanews.com. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Meantime, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence said Tuesday a U.S. embassy in Jerusalem remains a possibility.
And the President of the United States, as we speak, is giving serious consideration to moving the American embassy in Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
Moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem would anger Palestinians who want East Jerusalem as a future capital and part of their sovereign territory. Such a move would also distance the U.S. from most of the international community, including its closest allies in Western Europe and the Arab world. Former U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton is speaking out about two factors she believes help lead to the loss she suffered in last year's 2016 presidential election.
It wasn't a perfect campaign. There is no such thing. But I was on the way to winning until the combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of people who were inclined to vote for me but got scared off.
Clinton said she would offer more details and analysis of her electoral defeat in a book she is publishing this fall. An election analysis released this week by a group of top Democratic Party strategists suggests the main reason Clinton lost is because a large number of voters that backed President Obama in 2012 voted for Trump. Hate crimes have surged since President Trump's election in November, amplifying worries about the Justice Department's commitment to carrying on the previous administration's anti-hate crime campaign. From mosque arsons to vandalism of Jewish community centers, American Muslims and Jews have borne the brunt of most of the recent escalation in hate crimes. And advocates worry many offenses go unpunished, that is. The U.S. Justice Department sought to calm those concerns on Tuesday, saying it is going after hate crimes just as aggressively as it did under the Obama administration. And Greece reached a deal with its European leaders Tuesday for more reforms in exchange for a badly needed bailout installment so Athens could avoid a possible bankruptcy. After months of tough talks, Greek officials agreed to more pension cuts and tax increases. The Greek prime minister's leftist government says that it's confident Parliament will approve the new round of cuts. Greece desperately needs about $8 billion to meet a debt payment in July or stare possible bankruptcy in the face. And global health experts striving to identify a mysterious illness in Liberia that has already killed 12 people. The illness causes fever, vomiting, diarrhea, and headaches. Authorities are looking at food most of the victims may have consumed at a recent funeral service in Sonoma County. I'm Michael Brown reporting here in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today is World Press Freedom Day, and the report card from Southern Africa is not good.
We are basically saying that over the past year, we have seen persistent attacks on media freedoms here in the region, which has greatly undermined the press freedom, and as well, it's threatening the growth of the media landscape here in the region.
Raboshi Vambu is the media manager for Amnesty International Southern Africa region. Ugandan journalists and media activists say they continue to face harassment. We will have a report about three bloggers under Ethiopia's state of emergency, and the drumbeat gets louder for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to take a medical leave.
In the absence of information from the highest quarters as to what is happening, people are feeding all manner of rumors. You know, there are tales about how the president has been poisoned and all of that.
Chidi Odinkalu is the chair of the practice of the Section on Public Interest and Development Law at the Nigerian Bar Association. A dozen people are dead from a mysterious illness in Liberia's southeastern region. And we'll examine oil prices and their impact on military spending in Africa. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Today, Wednesday, is World Press Freedom Day, declared by the United Nations to raise awareness about the importance of freedom of the press and remind governments of their duty to respect and uphold the right to freedom of expression. In a report released today, Wednesday, Amnesty International says persistent attacks against journalists and media owners are threatening press freedom and the growth of independent media across Southern Africa. Robert Chivambu is media manager for Amnesty International's Southern Africa region. He says the attacks have had a chilling effect on those working in the media from Angola to Zambia.
We are basically saying that over the past year, we have seen persistent attacks on media freedoms here in the region, which has greatly undermined the press freedom. And as well, it's threatening the growth of the media landscape here in the region. So from Angola to Zambia, we have seen disturbingly brazen attacks on press freedoms, which have a chilling effect on those working in the media across the region. So if we were to go to specific examples, we would know about the case in Lesotho of the former editor of the Lesotho Times, Lloyd Mutungamiri, who narrowly survived a shooting after being attacked by unknown gunmen on the 9th of July on his driveway in Maseru when he was coming back from work in the evening. As a result of that, he had to abandon his job in Lesotho and return back home to Zimbabwe. Another journalist working for the same newspaper, Kiso Mushobodi, she worked for the Lesotho Times in the same country. She had to leave the country fearing for her own safety as a result of police intimidation for investigative work exposing corruption in the police. In a country like Botswana, journalists continue to face harassment and intimidation for carrying out investigative and critical journalism.
You mentioned Zambia. Until then, yes. Zambia used to be a good example of media freedom. Lately, since the President Lungu took over, we saw the Zambian Post newspaper was not publishing. What went wrong in Zambia?
Zambia is another worrying country for us because over the past year, on the 28th of June last year, we saw the closure of the Post newspaper. Well, there's context to that because the Post newspaper has been a very critical newspaper. And leading up to the elections last year, they were critical in terms of reporting about the state of the nation. So I think those are some of the things that have not sat down very, very well with the authorities in the country. So they've been targeted and effectively shut down. They were accused of owing some tax money. So for us, if a newspaper has got outstanding taxes that it has to pay, the state has to find a way to come to some sort of arrangement with the newspaper to be able to settle its bill, unlike shutting it down. Because when you shut it down, you are critically closing these voices that are meant to provide for checks and balances in a democratic country like Zambia.
Now, South Africa, where you are, I see in your examples some information about the South African Broadcasting Corporation. I know lately there have been reports on corruption in South Africa. What is the issue with the restriction on media there?
South Africa has traditionally had a very vibrant media coming from President Nelson Mandela's government to Thabo Mbeki and now under President Jacob Zuma. But what we are seeing lately, a situation which really worries us a lot,
So on this World Press Freedom Day, what encouragement can you give those struggling journalists in Southern Africa and elsewhere in Africa to continue to do their work?
At Amnesty International, we are very mindful that the struggle of journalists to be able to put stories together on a daily basis are real. Their struggle is a real one because every day they are facing intimidation from the state. They are being harassed. They are being threatened.
Robert Chivambu is the media manager for Amnesty International Southern Africa region. He was speaking with me from South Africa. Journalists and media activists in Uganda say they continue to face harassment and are prevented to cover issues of national dialogue. Journalists say they are often harassed, beaten, and tortured by security forces while doing their work. But Ugandan police spokesperson Asan Kasinge says the police know the importance of the media and will punish any member of the security who doesn't respect the rights of journalists in the country. Mugumi Davis Rakarinji reports from Kampala.
According to Reporters Without Borders barometer, Uganda dropped 10 places and is now ranked 112th out of 180 countries globally. The media watchdog says there have been what it says are grave attacks on media in recent days. It says acts of intimidation and violence against journalists are almost a daily occurrence in Uganda. Reporters Without Borders says there have been internet cuts, verbal and physical attacks on reporters, especially those covering the opposition. Stephen Oumabuire is the General Secretary of Uganda Journalism Union. Oumabuire agrees with Reporters Without Borders. He says journalists are often arrested, detained or beaten while doing their work in Uganda.
When we report a group that is rioting in town, maybe they are demonstrating over unfair treatment at work, or maybe their rights have been violated, the security agencies or people who are in security might come and just disperse the crowd, including the press. There is no distinction between the journalists and the people who are rioting.
Every year, 3rd of May is a date which celebrates the fundamental principles of press freedom to evaluate press freedoms around the world. It is also a day to defend the media from attacks on their independence and to pay tribute to journalists who have lost their lives in the exercise of their profession. Photojournalist Andrew Murwanyi says there are some stories that he simply cannot dare to do.
There is no way you can go and investigate on a given story. First of all, the stakeholders in the government, first of all, they're not ready to give out information about the government. You get me? Second of all, if they see that you're over asking about or you're over investigating about a given subject, they will start to call you and threaten you. You see, they make those funny phone calls that if you don't stop asking about this thing or writing about this thing or filming about this thing, you'll get arrested or you'll be taken away.
Uganda Police Spokesperson, Assistant Inspector of Police, Asani Kasinje, agrees some members of security have infringed on the rights of journalists. But he says those involved have been penalized.
We have even laws that hold individual officers in their individual capacity if they abuse people's rights. And I think that these are rights that journalists have. For example, there was the DPC of Old Kampala. He assaulted the journalist and I think destroyed his camera in the course of his work. He was taken to court and he was convicted.
Kasinje says, in fact, journalists help the police to do their work by exposing evils in the society. I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Today's Wednesday, May 3rd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Ethiopia's state of emergency has seen thousands of people detained, allegedly, in connection with the unrest last year in the Oromia region. Those arrested have included journalists and bloggers. Martha van der Wolf sat down with three of them in Addis Ababa ahead of World Press Freedom Day today, Wednesday.
University lecturer and commentator Suyum Tshoma was arrested in October and detained for 2 months after he gave a radio interview to Deutsche Welle in which he criticized the government. Since his release, he has continued to post several times a week on various political blogs and social media about current affairs.
I got so many warnings from the local officials, from the command post, from the security officials. It's very, very risky. If you stop, that means that you are just surrendering to that fear. So to confront that fear, you have to keep writing. So I'm going to keep writing to challenge the fear that they want to sustain this country.
Ethiopia's government spokesman did not answer phone calls for comment. However, the government has repeatedly said over the years that those arrested are terrorists posing as journalists. Reporters Without Borders says the state of emergency declared in October has further curtailed press freedom and access to information. As a result, Reporters Without Borders ranked Ethiopia 150 out of 180 countries in its 2017 World Press Freedom Index. That is 8 spots lower than the previous year. Blogger Befakadu Hailu says he has seen the change firsthand.
When you freely express yourself before the state of emergency, you have the risk of getting jailed, but the security officials have to come up with an excuse to take you to court. Now, they don't need any excuse.
Befakadu has been detained twice. He was arrested in 2014 in relation with the Zone 9 Bloggers Collective and held for a year and a half on charges of terrorism and inciting violence by writing. He was arrested again last November and held for 40 days, this time without formal charge. Like many arrested under the state of emergency, he was held at a rehabilitation camp. The government says detainees are given courses on the constitution and civic values.
I have met a lot of youngsters who were severely beaten and tortured. I have heard a lot of stories that put me in a responsibility to speak about them, because most of them do not have any access to the press or even social media. So I have the responsibility of speaking about the voiceless. So it is a mixed feeling that I come out after the rehabilitation.
Under the state of emergency, Ethiopians have been banned from looking at certain media outlets. Social media websites such as Facebook are still blocked in the country. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The drumbeat for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to take a medical leave because of his health is getting louder. In a letter titled, President Buhari Should Take Medical Leave Immediately, 13 civil society leaders urged the president to listen to the advice of his doctors and take a medical leave without further delay. In recent weeks, Mr. Buhari has missed 3 cabinet meetings and last Friday prayer. Today, Wednesday, is another executive council meeting, and some of the president's supporters say those calling for him to step aside should hold their fire until if the president does not chair today's meeting. First Lady Aisha Buhari took to the Twitter on Tuesday to say that her husband's health was not as bad as it has been perceived. Chidi Odinkalu is the chair of the practice of the Section on Public Interest and Development Law at the Nigerian Bar Association. He says Nigerians are justified by their interest in the well-being of their president.
I think Nigerians are justifiably worried because over the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks since he returned to Nigeria, very little has been seen of the president. Last week, the cabinet didn't meet. The week before that, he was not in cabinet either, nor the week before that. So for 3 weeks, he's not been seen in cabinet. And last week, he wasn't at the Friday prayer, and we all know that President Buhari is a devout worshipper. And I think adding all of that together, what it's meant is that Nigerians have begun to express worries about the state of his well-being, and that's justifiable.
Now, you mentioned the cabinet meeting. Well, today, Wednesday, is another executive council meeting. There are those who, at least the president's supporters, who are saying, let the public wait and see whether the president is going to chair this particular meeting. And once he chairs it, then all the worries about his health should be put aside. What do you think?
I think the language of the president's supporters is somewhat worrying. The people who are saying that the president needs looking after properly are not necessarily the president's opponents. Look, Nigerians want their country to work. We want our country to work. It's immaterial who you voted for, who you supported in elections. Nigerians don't want a country that does not work, and we don't want a country that is not properly run. That is the underlying issue. And one cabinet meeting does not in any way address the underlying concerns that there is a serious crisis on which the country is not being briefed properly. Nobody's saying exactly what is happening. Things are being done in the name of a president that people are unable to see, and that is very worrying.
I think your point is well taken, because a statement issued by the founding national chairman of the All Progressive Congress Party, Chief B.C. Akande, echoing what you said, that the health of the leader of Nigeria is intricately intertwined with the health of the nation. Exactly. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. And you see, there is something else. The fact of the matter is, around the country right now, there are, in the absence of information from the highest quarters as to what is happening, people are feeding all manner of rumors. You know, there are tales about how the president has been poisoned and all of that. And all of that, Nigeria is a very fragile place. This kind of information can conflagrate the country, can burn the place. And it's very important that the people running the country know this, because if Nigeria burns, all of West Africa burns. That cannot be allowed. Because of that, the people running the country must understand the responsibility they've got to inform Nigerians properly as to what is happening, and inform the world too, because this does have regional security consequences.
Chidi Odinkalu is the chair of the practice of the Section on Public Interest and Development Law at the Nigerian Bar Association. He was speaking with me from London, United Kingdom. A dozen people are dead from a mysterious illness first reported in southeastern Liberia. The most recent deaths happened in the capital, Monrovia, but they were from the original group that attended a funeral in Saino County in late April, and it has not spread beyond that group. Ebola and Lassa fever have both been ruled out as the culprit, but health officials are tracing the survivors of the illness as well as other contacts, and trying to determine what the cause is and how to stop it. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Francis Carter talked to Ricky Stryak about how their response is different.
Ebola has been ruled out. We have done Lassa, we've done E. coli, and no, we haven't seen anything yet and so forth. But there are a lot of things we are doing. Personally, we have done on those patients that are survivor and so forth. We've done their complete chemistry and doing liver profile. So we are doing almost everything, looking at, okay, what is the cause? And now we are seeing some signs and symptoms on those that have recovered. And so based on these signs and symptoms, we are following specific leads that will lead us to actually pinpointing if it were a toxin, what kind of toxin, you know, it was. And also, we are in the process of pathology, or forensic pathology will be coming in country within the next 2 to 3 days in order to do an autopsy on the two bodies in Monrovia. We have preserved them and want to do an autopsy to at least give us a clearer picture of what, you know, what we are dealing with.
It hasn't spread out of the same cluster.
That is correct. Yeah, that spread out of the cluster.
Are these people, whoever was at the funeral, are they all being contact traced as one would if it was an Ebola case? You know, what are people doing to monitor those who might be infected?
Sure. What we've done so far is that we have, based on the fact that we are dealing with something unknown, so we have put into action contact tracing and so forth, and monitor those people that are closer to those that have either expired or those that were infected. But the good sign is that we have not seen that even at the hospital, nurses and health workers that have dealt with the infected cases, none of them have come down with any. So I think that is giving a clear indication that this may not be an infectious disease that could spread from, that is transmissible from person to person and so forth. So we are not ruling out anything.
How are both the public and the government reacting differently to this after everything that you know from the Ebola crisis? How is the reaction different if this had happened 5 years ago from now?
Had this happened 5 years ago, definitely we would have a major panic around the country. But because of the Ebola experience and the capacity that has been built within country, and the fact that there are a lot of things that we have put in place in terms of laboratory, diagnostic equipment, and so forth, so I think we have been very effective. Were we tested? No, we're not tested. And this is why after the response is over, we will sit down and do a post-mortem on our own activities.
And do you think you guys are treating this more seriously because of the Ebola outbreak?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think now we are very, very conscious. We are not letting our guards down.
Dr. Francis Kate is Chief Medical Officer and Deputy Minister of Health of Liberia. You're speaking to Ricky Stryak from Monrovia. Low oil prices are driving cutbacks in military spending across Africa. Salim Solomon reports.
African military expenditures have finally slowed down after more than a decade of steady increases, according to a new report on global defense spending. The main reason? A drop in oil prices.
The sharp decreases in oil prices has affected quite a number of African countries, namely South Sudan, Angola. And this has kind of driven almost the entire regional trend. A couple of countries have been really affected by the low oil prices, and this has affected the regional spending level in Africa.
That was Nan Tian, a researcher at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute's SIPRI, Arms and Military Expenditure Program, the organization that authored the report. The SIPRI report found military spending in Africa in 2016 was down by 1.3% from the previous year and totaled about $37.9 billion. Despite the drop, Africa's military spending remains 48% higher than it was a decade ago.
A few of the top spenders within these regions are generally oil economies. And so the low oil prices have meant sharp cutbacks in government financing. Of that includes military spending. And because quite a few of these countries account for quite a large share of the regional spending, a decrease in one country's spending, a sharp decrease, would actually lead to regional changes.
Some of Africa's biggest spenders in recent years have included oil-rich Angola, which has sought to modernize its air force and navy, and Algeria, which has tried to preserve its stability amid the collapse of Libya and the rise of extremism in North Africa. Both of those countries have slowed spending recently, Tian said. He added that perhaps the most important question to ask is whether military spending in Africa is at appropriate levels. 10 African countries have military expenditures greater than 3% of their GDP. The highest are the Republic of the Congo, where military expenditures totaled 7% of GDP in 2016, and Algeria, where military spending totaled 6.7% of GDP. Globally, military spending is 2.2% of GDP, or about $227 per person.
Sure, you have the security aspect, but also in Africa, we have the opportunity cost. It is the poorest continent. So the question is, should this continent be spending, are they spending enough or are they spending too much on military spending based on their current maybe income levels? Should they rather be prioritizing other aspects of spending? Maybe it's healthcare, maybe it's education, maybe it's infrastructure.
Not all African countries saw a decline in military spending. According to the report, Botswana's military spending grew by 40%, or about $152 million. Botswana is regularly noted for having a long record of peace and good governance and is undergoing a military modernization program. Nigeria increased its military spending by 1.2% to $1.7 billion as it strives to defeat the radical Islamist group Boko Haram. Similarly, Kenya and Mali increased military spending due to extremist threats in their regions. I'm Salim Solomon for VOA News, Washington, D.C.
And that's it for this Wednesday, May 30 edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a nice day.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.